Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 6th of February, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish.
Well, we're getting straight on with Brexit, unfortunately. But it is a marginally interesting aspect of this. Now, if we go back to 2016, not long after the referendum, Alex Thompson, the issue of the Northern Irish border was being discussed, and Alex Thompson mentioned the common travel area, the CTA. Well, the government has now made a statement about this. This is Robin Barnett, the UK ambassador to Ireland, about the common travel area. And he's saying, I would like to reassure you that the UK and Irish governments have worked intensively on measures to ensure continuation of the CTA. We have an agreement which is almost ready to sign. This work reflects the fact that right from the start of the EU exit process and throughout the negotiations, the Prime Minister has been clear that maintaining the UK and Ireland's common travel area is a top priority for the UK. Now, I haven't heard this mentioned in the mainstream press at all. Been no discussion of it right from the very beginning. He went on to say the CTA is a long-standing agreement between the UK, the Crown Dependencies of Jersey, Guernsey and the Isle of Man, and Ireland, and has its origins in the 1920s, long before either the UK or Ireland were joined the EU. He goes on to discuss an article by Dr. Butler saying it's complex, it's never been codified into a coherent collection of documents. And so officials across the whole of government in both countries have worked together to create a solid framework for the CTA to ensure that the rights and privileges UK and Irish nationals enjoy in each other's countries will continue, whatever the circumstances of the UK's exit from the EU. So that's good. Basically, there will be no hard border because there can't be. There's a common travel area. That means that we can travel to each other's countries without requiring visas, without any problems about crossing borders and so on. Yep. We'll see how this interfaces with the backstop, but I just find it interesting that mainstream press hasn't discussed this issue at all.
Well, maybe we're not so surprised at that, Mike. Well, how that system works, though, that's where the question is.
Well,
how do
absolutely.
They control the press?
Now, most people have seen this by now, but I thought we would just mention it. Jeremy Corbyn, this is the Red Roar. Now, nobody really seems to know who's behind this website. It seems to be reasonably anti-Corbyn in general. But anyway, this is him speaking. There's a tweet from them showing a video of him speaking in 2009, shortly before the second Lisbon Treaty referendum in Ireland. He said that he regretted that Britain was not holding a similar referendum to the Irish on the issue of the Lisbon Treaty. He said that the Irish would be holding a third referendum if the vote was no again, and they shouldn't really destroy their posters and so on because they're going to need them. But the interesting point of this for me came at the very end of the video, Brian, because he started talking about the military. He was clearly recognising that the Lisbon Treaty represented, as he described it, the EU becoming a military Frankenstein, a monster. In other words, he recognised that the military union aspect of the Lisbon Treaty. But for some reason, he's pretty silent on that issue today. And I'm not really clear why that might be, because he clearly understood the implications of it.
I was quite stunned when I heard the clip this morning, Mike, because it's the vehemence in his voice when he's warning specifically about it becoming a military monster, a Frankenstein. So he knew then, he was prepared in front of this audience to speak out and warn people, and he sounded concerned.
Yes.
This is the interesting thing, he sounded concerned about it. So why can't he speak out now? And one of the things that you suggested was that this is to do with pressure from inside the Labour Party itself. So yes, he's leader, but he knows that if he doesn't toe the party line from deep inside the party, then probably he's not going to be leader for much longer.
Well, I don't
is
think
that the case?
I don't think it's even the party line. I think it's the fact that he's under such pressure from the Blairite faction within the party, within the parliamentary party. Over the weekend, Lord Adonis was on the television again talking about if Theresa May's bill goes through or deal goes through, the Labour Party is likely to split. Now, of course, Lord Adonis is absolutely a Blairite and is promoting Tony Blair's desire to see the Labour Party split.
Yeah.
And a third so-called moderate middle-of-the-road party appear. But nonetheless, The irony of it is, Brian, that if Corbyn would just take a proper stand on these issues, he would find he has much more support than he has at the moment.
Tremendous support. Maybe one of the things we can say, though, is it shows again the power of the party system to control what individuals think. So Corbyn not brave enough to speak out in 2018 on this subject. The power of the party. There's a lot to be said for no parties and people being accountable for their words and deeds as an individual.
Now, sticking with military matters, Baroness Tong has asked a parliamentary question. She asked it on the 22nd of January 2019 to ask Her Majesty's government why they have invited the Israeli Air Force to join the Royal Air Force in Exercise Cobra Warrior in September 2019 and what consideration they give when awarding a contract to Elbit Systems UK of the use of that company by the government of Israel. So what's she talking about? Well, Elbit produces drones and Elbit Systems, actually, although the contract is between the Ministry of Defence and Elbit Systems UK, Elbit Systems itself is based in Haifa. It's Israel's largest publicly traded arms and security company. It's growing fast. Is acquiring companies hand over fists, particularly since the turn of the century, and is now employing over 11,500 people. 85% of the drones used by the Israeli military are manufactured by Elbit. And of course, they have been accused of killing 1,400 Palestinians during the 2009 Operation Cast Lead attack. And that's according to Human Rights Watch. And Human Rights Watch said the Hermes can stay aloft for up to 24 hours at altitudes of up to 18,000 feet and has an array of optical, infrared and laser sensors that allow the operator to identify and track targets as well as to guide munitions in flight. The Hermes carries two Spike medium-range missiles. And as I say, the Israelis using these drones in Gaza and the West Bank. And that's really what she's talking about. So this question was answered by Earl Howe, as these usually are, yesterday. And he said, Her Majesty's government works closely with the Israeli Defence Force in order to counter the destabilising regional activity of Iran and Hezbollah and to conduct operations against Daesh. The IDF also provides crucial access and overflight for the RAF to be able to conduct air operations in support of Operation Shader. Accordingly, in support of this important defence relationship, the RAF invited the Israeli Air Force to join Exercise Cobra Warrior alongside RAF, German and Italian Air Force units. The exercise enables participating air forces to learn mutual lessons from operating together. So that's brilliant. And he went on to discuss Elbit Systems because under this contract, they're providing the British Army with operationally proven battle management applications for both headquarters and tactical units, according to Earl Howe. And as with all MOD contractors, we assess the legal and financial status of a company before placing a contract. But apparently, the moral aspect of it really doesn't come into these decisions. I suppose, why should they?
Well, I can think of quite a lot of reasons why it might, but it's fascinating that, of course, it isn't just drones, is it? Because under Francis Maude, we had the announcement that GCHQ and Israel were going to be linked. We were going to have a link between the work that GCHQ does and Israel and security services and links through to a specialist unit. I think it's called 4200. A part of military intelligence. We had British police going to Israel for training. And we also saw that in this defence security network, there was also going to be a link up of universities with Israeli government organisations. So for some reason, we seem to be constantly drawn into these so-called partnerships arrangements with Israel, never debated openly in Westminster, simply announced by the government. But why is there this underwritten allegiance with Israel? I find this one very difficult because if you look on a world stage and say, what has Israel actually done to assist UK? I'm puzzled to find an answer for that. And in fact, many people of a certain age would think back to the Falklands when, of course, Israel was actually helping to arm adversaries for UK. Mm. I think it's a very dangerous situation and more questions to be asked.
Okay, well, good news, Brian. Jens Stoltenberg is coming to London in December. He has announced today that NATO will be holding its next heads of state and government meeting in London. He said, "We are grateful to the United Kingdom for agreeing to host this meeting in NATO's 70th anniversary year. London was the home of NATO's first headquarters. The United Kingdom is one of the Alliance's 12 founding members and continues to play a key role in the Alliance, making essential contributions to our shared security." So he's saying, yay, I'm coming to London. Well, so is Donald Trump. He's coming to London too. So he's going to take part in that meeting. Theresa May was equally gushing. The UK, one of the founding members. December's meeting is an important opportunity. Blah, 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 blah. But anyway, what's the point of this? Well, this is all about NATO's future direction. And so this is an important meeting because I'm quite certain that Federica Mogherini will be there, High Representative of the European Union. I'm quite sure she'll be there, and she and Jens will get on very well, as they usually do. And this is all about NATO's future direction and future status. And so I think this is a key meeting that we will be watching the preparations for very closely.
What fascinates me on this, Mike, is that we've got all these discussions on improving, what is it, to determine the steps we must now take to modernise the alliance. Mm. We're going to modernise the alliance. We can't run the British Army or the Royal Air Force or the Royal Navy at the moment. We can't get the European defence system to work. Now they've switched topic. It's always a discussion for jam in the future without actually producing anything on the table today. Mm. So what is this about? Defence of NATO because of the now declared intent to create an EU defence, unified defence system?
Well, I think it's about what is the future structure of NATO going to be within that, or rather, how is the EU defence structure going to fit within NATO? I think that's absolutely what the case of it. But in the meantime, well, here's Jens Stoltenberg again, because NATO has signed an agreement with Macedonia, which is going to clear the way for Macedonia to join NATO. Each NATO member state has to ratify this decision, but that's a formality. And of course, this comes after the Greek parliament last month agreed a deal, which ends the row over the name of the country. So the Republic of Macedonia is going to join. Sorry, the Republic of North Macedonia, rather, is going to join NATO. So just to put that in a little bit of perspective, there it is there. So right between Albania and Bulgaria, again, NATO reinforcing its footprint in the Balkans. So they're all pretty excited about it. Today is an historic day. All NATO allies have signed the accession protocol with Macedonia, which will bring more security and prosperity to the whole region. I wonder what Russia's attitude to that would be. What do you think?
Well, they're going to be watching closely. Everything we see at the moment is the creation of the EU empire. That's the words that the European Union is using itself. It's creating one massive military complex. I think the Russians are concerned, and I think they're right to be concerned. Mm. Corbyn was warning in 2009.
He was using the term European Empire in 2009, indeed. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's have a look at this. Just alerted to the Cabinet Office Twitter page today. I always pick up on the images and this one, the banner headline. You could say, well, it's an interesting little sketch. But to me, when I look at it, Mike, it introduces that sort of cartoon feel into government. It starts to sort of distort reality a bit, maybe just my impression. But why were we interested? Well, basically, we're interested because of this particular post here. Well, there's two of them. The first one is today, Cabinet Office Ministers Liddington, Norwich, Chloe, Oliver Dowden, and Brandon Lewis are answering questions in UK Parliament about the Cabinet Office. Now, the timing of this interests me, Mike, because we've started to be asking questions about the Cabinet Office and what it does and the immense power that the Cabinet Office seems to have. We haven't been able to tune into that discussion so far, but we will follow up on it. But this is a key question. Cabinet Office, the the seat of power in government,
yes.
and yet nobody really understands how it works. So is it that we've now got some MPs, backbenchers, starting to ask the right questions? We'll see. But the other one that caught our attention was this one down here. It says, today, Minister for the Constitution at Norwich, Chloe, spoke at the AEA conference 2019 about the importance of working collaboratively across the electoral community to improve the voting experience for disabled people. Now, with no disrespect to disabled people, we've got the Brexit at the moment, which is the main subject with huge constitutional issues. She doesn't seem to be focusing on those. She's focusing in on disabled matters. This seems to be slightly wrong to me. But also, if you go on this lady's Twitter page, you'll see that she's also very big on the Chinese New Year. So this is her page. Down at the bottom, it's got Kung Hai Fat Chow. I would like to offer my warmest wishes to the Norwich Chinese community and wish you a very happy New Year. So she's plenty of time for doing that sort of thing. But what has actually been going on here? Well, this is one of the things that she's been involved with, that she was speaking out at the 29th Governing Council meeting of the AT community of DEM. Well, what is that? I wasn't too sure, but we followed it through. And it's the Community of Democracies, which has the interesting objection that all... Sustained. Sorry, I missed that. I obviously said something not quite right there. That all human rights be promoted and protected. So this is another one of these amazing organisations which is going to look after all of humanity in every country. Yeah. There's not going to be any problems. So she's not doing her job, as far as I'm concerned, as an MP. She's got time to bring in the Chinese New Year. But here she is working with this interesting organisation. And what sort of thing are they talking about? Well, what's the vision? The vision is a world where every nation respects and upholds the core democratic values, principles and standards of the Warsaw Declaration. Now, I'm not sure whether you were familiar with the Warsaw Declaration, Mike. I have to say I wasn't. We'll come on to that in a minute. The mission, the Community of Democracies, is a global intergovernmental coalition committed to taking concerted action to advance and protect democratic freedoms, strengthen democratic institutions and expand political participation. Governing Council member states do this by abiding by core democratic principles in practice, supporting one another, meeting the objectives they set for themselves, responding to threats to democracy and working closely with civil society. This is utopia, Mike.
Is France part of this?
I didn't see them on the list, actually, right. But of course you're asking that comment because the French government at the moment is busy brutalising its own citizens with bullets and gas. Core values and principles. Through the Warsaw Declaration and subsequent ministerial declarations, member states have consistently reaffirmed their commitment to core democratic values, partnership with civil society, dialogue with peer learning. It goes on and on and on. In Newspeak. Now, this is what our MPs are doing instead of looking after the governance of the country and sorting out attacks on the UK constitution. Here is the Warsaw Declaration. Now, this was actually signed in, I think that's June 2000, towards a community of democracies. Print is a little bit too small for me on screen, but I, in reading through that great long list, I didn't remember seeing France, but perhaps they are there. Somebody can freeze that page and have a look. But let's bring up the rest of it here, because they're talking about expressing our common adherence to the purposes and principles set forth in the Charter of the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, reaffirming our commitment to respect relevant instruments of international law, interdependence between peace, development, human rights and democracy. And on it goes with that vast list. Now, I've only been able to get one page up there. The will of the people should be the basis of the authority of government. Well, that's not happening anywhere.
Not that I'm...
It's certainly not happening in France, and I don't think it's happening in UK. But we'll read it again. The will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government as expressed by exercise of the right and civic duties of citizens to choose their representatives through regular, free and fair elections. Except when you get the wrong answer and then you're asked to do it again, Mike. But this is very, very detailed stuff. Are any members of the UK general public actually aware that this thing was signed and that we've got MPs spending their time on it? I don't think so. But have a look at some of the detail here. So we work with civil society pillar. Now, there's already a few people in the chat box talking about the language, and I'll just say brace yourself for this one. Civil society is an integral part of democracy, and the community of democracies has long made support for non-governmental actors who represent the interests of citizens, an important priority of its work around the world.
Sorry, can I just clarify something there?
Yeah.
When did any non-governmental actor represent the interests of citizens as opposed to the interests of some vested interest? For example, the biggest civil society actor perhaps on the planet is George Soros, and he is rarely operating in the interests of citizens, as far as I can see.
This is absolutely correct, Mike, and just before you take that one down, the other paragraph there, civil society is represented at the Governing Council by the International Steering Committee, an independent representative body elected by the Civil Society Assembly. Now, I tried to delve into this to find actually who they were talking about, and I couldn't really see, but it's independent, don't worry about it. It appears to be a group of individuals put themselves into a position of power, and then because they elect their colleagues, we should be happy with it.
Is this some form of parallel government?
I would say so, yes. Have a look at this one, because here we've got civil society standards. In March 2016, the Governing Council adopted civil society standards, a document which lays out a series of steps that democratic governments, that comprise the community will take to support and protect civil society. The Academic Advisory Board is an international panel of eminent academic experts established with a goal of providing the community access to the brightest minds working in the areas of democratic theory and practice. And the only name there is it's under the leadership of Dr. Sadursky, a professor of jurisprudence at the University of Sydney. He's involved in New York. But who is this man and who actually elected him and his colleagues? Well, we don't know. But of course, this is not just a website. This is an organisation that MPs are already engaged in. Norwich Chloe, in this particular case. And where is this agenda taking to us to? Well, we can see here pretty clearly, because one of the things that they are very big on is Agenda 2030. So this is all of the recreation of the world with these requirements as to how things are going to be. So we've got sustainable development goals for human rights, gender equality, global partnership for sustainable development. This goes on and on. And if we bring it full circle, here's Chloe Smith. I'm not sure why she's in her dressing gown in a park. I'm sure she's got a particularly good reason for that. But this MP is not dealing with any of the matters in the country. She's involved with this organisation which says, well, never mind the chaos in the NHS, the potholes in the road. We are going to create a new world, a utopia.
So when we look at this organisation, we look at the way that the Commonwealth is being used along the same lines. We look at the regionalisation policy and agenda through the cities and part of the Global Parliament of Mayors. We're seeing all these globalist, so-called, in inverted commas, democratic civil society organisations pressing ahead, building institutions that in general are never
structures.
Which are generally never discussed in the mainstream press. Yeah. If you ask the average man in the street, If he had ever heard of any of these organisations, I'm quite certain he would say no. Yeah. And so why are they doing these things in secret? And they'll say that they're not doing them in secret because they've got websites and they're taking part in meetings that are public and so on. But if they're not appearing in the press and people don't know about them, then they're secret, aren't they?
Well, they're hidden in plain sight is probably the best description, but you're absolutely right. So back in 2000, when was the British public told that we were about to sign up to this? What agreement did the voting public give? The answer is none at all. And yet we've now got these duplicitous MPs involved with this sort of stuff while they, I think, neglect their duties to the rest of the problems in the country. So it's very insidious stuff, and it's increasing. This is not reducing, Mike. What is the Cabinet Office doing that it is promoting this stuff? What is the Conservative Party doing that it's promoting it?
And of course, we should have not passed by without mentioning the most important civil society organisation, which is Common Purpose, of course, because they're usually right at the centre of this type of thing.
Yeah, well, we'll do some more, we'll do some more research on it.
Okay, quick reminder, if you like what we're doing and would like to support our work, please join the UK Column community. You can do that at ukcolumn.org/community. Also available on the UK Column website is the AV9.1 DVD box set with presentations by Brian, by Alex Thompson, Patrick Henningsen, Dr. Graham Downing and Ian R. Crane. So pick up a copy of that if you possibly can. And I just also wanted to mention that the people behind the Vaxxed documentary are in the process of producing Vaxxed 2. They're saying it's a follow-up to the award-winning documentary Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe. When we set out across America promoting Vaxxed, thousands of empowered parents travelled miles to share the stories of what happened to their children. These stories created a movement, a revolution that will change history forever. The parents have been lied to and will be silenced no longer. This is your story, your truth. And now we need your help to tell it. So they are raising money for this via Indiegogo. And if you can possibly help, then please do. You know, I attended the premiere of Vaxxed in London. And there were some people in that audience who had been damaged by vaccines themselves. So, you know, this isn't about being anti-vaccination as such. It's about being anti the suppression of the one side of the discussion. This needs to be discussed openly and honestly by all parties. And at the moment, it isn't being for reasons that we understand, because on the pharmaceutical side, people are having their careers ended and being silenced as much as possible. That has to change.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, speaking of civil society and NGOs, the Charity Commission has issued an official warning against the Institute for the Institute of Economic Affairs, rather. So the Charity Commission is obviously the regulator for charities in England and Wales. They're saying that the Institute of Economic Affairs has breached charities regulations through a paper that it published on its website. That paper was clearly political in its position. So the Commission finds that the report and its launch sought to explicitly change government policy on an issue unrelated to the charity's purposes. The charity claims that its purposes are furthering education, and that this constitutes a breach of the Commission's guidance on political activity and campaigning. They also find that the report was not sufficiently balanced and neutral as required by law from charities with educational purposes. Furthering education does not need to be value-free or completely neutral, but research reports must present balanced information allowing the reader to make up his or her own mind. In this case, the Commission found that the report was not sufficiently balanced and neutral, nor did the charity provide an equally prominent publication or event presenting a different view. So I find this quite an interesting development, Brian, because it's the first time that I have been aware of the Charity Commission taking this type of stand against one of these think tanks that claims to be pursuing educational goals, but in fact seems to be pursuing government policy goals, or at least an effort to change a government policy. So perhaps we might like to see the Charity Commission doing this much more often.
It's fascinating, isn't it? One of the departments we can say that does seem to do a good job in challenging other departments is the Information Commissioner's mm-hmm. office. But Charity Commission have sat in the background while charities which should not be political have been blatantly political. Common Purpose must be one of the key ones. So is it that they've decided to step forward and do something, or is it that they've reacted here because somebody has given them the evidence and said you need to do something?
I think the second is the case, and I think we need to be watching what these think tanks and charities are doing much more and taking action where we are able to do that.
Because they form participatory democracy. It is not the individual that's being counted in the decision-making process. It's third-party organisations, it's non-government organisations, it's charities, it's the third sector.
Which is funded by vested interests themselves.
Big money,
yes. But just briefly remind everybody, of course, in Scotland, the Scottish Charity Regulator has an inquiry open against the Institute for Statecraft. This is with respect to the Institute for Statecraft's involvement with the Integrity Initiative. There's been no further report on this just yet, but we are waiting to see what the Scottish Charity Regulator does there. Of course, that's another so-called charity pursuing a political agenda rather than some form of charitable work for the benefit of everyone.
Yeah, so you hide under the label of a charity, and most people are very relaxed about charities. Well, they're trying to do the right thing, but these are very devious organisations because, of course, the moment there's a political element in their work, who knows what the real objective is. Mm. And perhaps, excuse me, another organisation we should pay attention to is the World Economic Forum. Now, we've reported on their meetings numerous times over the years, but thank you very much to the viewer who saw this article. So here we are, World Economic Forum, mind control using sound waves. Excuse me, we ask a scientist how it works. Now, this is a major article put forward by the World Economic Forum. And yes, they were actually getting specialist advice as to how good these mind control systems are. Now, we haven't got time on the news to get into the detail of how they work, but essentially sound waves being used to interfere with the way people behave and indeed think. So this was the gentleman that was briefing the World Economic Forum, Anton Jerusalem. And I've just taken a couple of quotes from what he said. Encourage you to go to the World Economic Forum website and have a look for yourself. He said, well, to get straight to the science, the principle of non-invasive neuromodulation is to focus ultrasound waves into a region in the brain so that they all gather in a small spot. Then hopefully, given the right set of parameters, this can change the activity of the neurons. Ultrasound neuromodulation is something that definitely works, but that we still don't understand. What he means by that is they know that it works, but in some areas they don't understand how or why it works. And he went on to say, I can see the day coming where a scientist will be able to control what a person sees in their mind's eye by sending the right waves to the right place in their brain. My guess is that most objections will be similar to those we hear today about subliminal messages in advertisements, only much more vehement. Now, this is immensely dangerous stuff. And we know, of course, that the British government is already and has been boasting for years about its behavioural insights team, the so-called Nudge Unit, which is now a social company. Can't think of the exact words. But the British government is so pleased with its ability to change people's behaviour and thinking that it sold the technology to the United States and to Australia. There may be other countries now.
But they're not using this specific technique?
No, I was going to say they're not using this technique. The British government principally using neuro-linguistics, playing with language and grammar to get these effects from the voters. Now we're doing something much more sinister. But I want to remind people really who are the World Economic Forum and what are they talking about? This links back in with what we've just been reporting with Norwich Chloe. Now we're getting a shape of where this is going. So World Economic Forum, annual meeting of the Global Future Councils. I'm not sure I ever agreed to that as a UK voter. And they're talking about a new global architecture. And let's remind ourselves of the sorts of people that we've got involved with this. Immensely powerful globalists, bankers, corporations, legal people, very, very diverse, but range of powerful people. And now they are getting specialist briefs on how to use sound waves to change the way people think and behave. Mm. This is immensely dangerous, and people should be spreading this information to alert others.
Now, in France, we've mentioned France already, but the French lower house, the French parliament, has passed a bill which gives security forces, according to France 24 here, the power to ban suspected hooligans from demonstrating. This is being described as a controversial bid to crack down on violence that has marred yellow vest protests over the last 3 months. So the bill was approved by the French Parliament by 387 votes to 92, and it will now go to the upper house for approval there, and then potentially the constitution. Well, if it gets past the upper house, it'll go to the Constitutional Council. So this bill would also allow fines of up to €15,000 and a one-year prison term for any demonstrators covering or masking their faces to escape identification. Well, what happens if they mask their faces to escape the gas? That's the question. Now, as Vanessa Bailey pointed out on the Sunday Wire, on Sunday, the security forces in France, using the CASUR, the Black Bloc, to introduce these measures. And of course, the violence at these that is reported as coming from the Gilets Jaunes side is effectively coming from the Black Bloc, who are not being attacked by the police, who are not being challenged by the police in any way. So when the Black Bloc breaks windows or beats people up, the police stand back, and then the police attack the yellow vests themselves. This seems to all have been set up to push this legislation through. And the question then for France is it constitutional? Many, many people saying it absolutely is not. They're really attempting to suppress people's right to gather peacefully and protest. It's a pretty dangerous direction to go in.
But a massive vote for it, something like 380 to 70, all that sort of ratio. So I think this is fear in the establishment, Mike. And the French people I've been able to talk to are saying that Macron will have to go. They accept that he'll be replaced by a similar controlled individual, but they're saying that the damage that's already been done to the government at the moment is that he will have to go. So that will be interesting.
Okay, now here's Tom Watson, deputy leader of the Labour Party, of course, and they have decided that parallel with their Conservative colleagues, that digital tech firms are too big. They're going to have to be broken up, and he wants to create a digital bill of rights, give social media firms broad legal duty of care to protect their users. The scale of the largest companies is rightly the subject of scrutiny. We should take seriously the calls to break them up if it is in the public interest. And so that's what he's saying. He's saying that competition laws are not fit for the age of big data. Well, I think they are. I think they're not being applied appropriately. But the main problem here is not whether the competition laws are fit for the age of big data, but whether it is possible for any individual nation to do anything about these multinational companies like Facebook and so on, because how does the UK prevent Facebook's merger with Instagram when Facebook's not actually based in the UK? It can't. What are we talking about here? Labour helping to produce global governance institutions for dealing with these kinds of things. But the main point for me is, as I've said before, the policy here is to break up Facebook and Twitter and so on, because These platforms have allowed people to be extremely efficient in how information is distributed. And of course, if we break those up and re-silo the internet, to use their term, as it was before the big social media companies came along, then of course the individual silos, the individual discussion groups, sharing of information between those becomes a lot harder. It's actually a lot more difficult to get a message broadly understood amongst a larger body of people. So, you know, I understand why some people are calling for the breakup of Facebook and Twitter and so on, but I think you got to consider the implications of that in terms of actually being able to spread a message.
Yeah. Why should we want to spread messages? Well, let's end on this one. Independent reporting on the story, and this is our old friend Sarah Thornton. Of course, UK column was initially talking about Sarah Thornton when she was chief constable, Oxford and covering Oxford and Cherwell Valley. And this is the article. It says that basically a police chief who was forced to apologise for her role in one of Britain's worst child sex trafficking scandals is to lead the country's fight against modern slavery. So you'll be encouraged by that, Mike. Of course, you've been covering the value of the modern slavery industry and, well, how productive it is for the UK government. Sarah Thornton, who currently heads up the National Police Chiefs Council, NPCC, will become the Home Office's Independent Anti-Slavery Commissioner. Now, that's an interesting statement again, isn't it? The Home Office's Independent Anti-Slavery Commissioner. Her appointment is set to be announced officially next week. She was Chief Constable of Thames Valley when the force failed to help up to 373 children, mostly female, who were groomed, given vast quantities of drugs and alcohol, and sexually abused in Oxford. And of course, we were reporting well before those disclosures on the fact that Thames Valley failed to act when abuse was discovered at Oxford and Cherwell Valley College. But this is where it gets interesting, because the former Independent Anti-Slavery Commissioner, Kevin Hyland, resigned from the post last May, citing government interference in his work, saying independence was vital for the success of the role. It's very interesting because this has happened north of the border with a child abuse inquiry, government interference. And this lady was an ex-advisor to the previous commissioner, Emily Kenway. She said, "I know firsthand that our attitude of independence wasn't always appreciated by the Home Office. It risked being diminished further after the anti-slavery commissioner job specification was updated to state that the commissioner will be appraised by the Home Office." But this is an independent position, of course.
Of course it is, yes.
Well, we just remind people of the UK column front page. This is back in 2013. Birds of a feather, victims betrayed, officials honoured, conspiracy of silence or a common purpose, ? And of course, we were pointing out the relationship between Sarah Thornton, Sally Dickett, the head of Oxford and Cherwell Valley College at the time, and the chief executive of the local council, whose name escapes me. But we pointed out in the article that their involvement via the Common Purpose Network, one of these charities, of course, Mike, meant that there was no separation of powers. And of course, Sarah Thornton featured, and all three women had received gongs as a result of their work. Well, we just end on this one. Thank you very much to the person who alerted me to this simple tweet, but it said that the controller of BBC Radio 4, Gwyneth Williams, is to leave the BBC. This was back on the 21st of January this year. But what was of interest was, once again, have a look at the public comments, basically saying good riddance. And I've stopped listening to BBC Radio 4 because it's changed so much from what it used to be. So this is good to see people picking up, people coming forward and using social media to post these comments. And I'm sure that's another reason, Mike, why the government wants to now break down and censor social media so that the public isn't given too much of a voice and a platform for commenting. That's it from us for today. If you're not already a subscriber of UK Column, please consider taking out a subscription and or making a donation. We can only continue to do what we do with your financial support. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back at the same time on Friday. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.